It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we have the one word never to use when making conversation with a winemaker. It's phylloxera. Not too long ago, this little bug came close to wiping wine off the earth. British journalist Christy Campbell has tracked down the story. His book is The Botanist and the Vintner, How Wine Was Saved for the World. Well, the Sterns are halfway between Miami and Havana, where the Key West locals go for dynamite Cuban. Wine maverick Josh Wesson rises to my challenge. What to drink with cheese that smells like gym socks. Chef Jerry Traunfeld brings us spring's little orphan herb. And we get the skinny on the Harlem classic, chicken and waffles. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today, journalist Christy Campbell has the story of how the world nearly lost wine. This really happened. Now, Christy's book is The Botanist and the Vintner, How Wine Was Saved for the World. My pressing question for the week is, what do you drink with stinky cheeses? Well, our wine maverick Josh Wesson has the answer, and it isn't what you think. We look at that Harlem specialty chicken and waffles and at the upcoming PBS special, The Meaning of Food. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, we have got a whole new gang of listeners, WLRN in Miami. So what have you got for these guys?
South Florida is a wonderful place to eat. The last time we were there, we arrived in Miami, and we headed southwest towards Havana. And when we got more than halfway to Havana and couldn't go any further, we were, of course, in Key West. And there in Key West, we found a restaurant called El Ciboney, named after an Indian chief named El Ciboney. It is a Cuban restaurant where the locals eat. Nothing fancy. It's not really tourist-oriented. It's just a wonderful town cafe with picadillo, fabulous Cuban mix sandwiches.
Ropa viejo. And my totally, totally, totally favorite thing, plantains, fried plantains.
Oh.
Do you love those?
I love those, yeah.
They can live on plantains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, also, Michael told me this is wonderful, but it is, I'm dealing with superlatives today. This is the only thing I am hideously allergic to is conch chowder. My head swells up. I look like SpongeBob SquarePants if I eat it. But Michael said they had a very good conch chowder.
Well, it's really meaty. I mean, it has lots of pieces of conch, you know, chopped fine, because conch is not the tenderest of things. But
yeah,
it has a really good ocean flavor. And of course, it's served with like long lengths of buttered Cuban toast, you know, which is that it's like French bread, but somehow more elegant. And it's just great for like sort of mopping the last of your conch chowder out of the bowl.
Is this place sort of a coffee shop kind of place, or?
Well, it's
a luncheonette, maybe.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think they serve three meals a day there. And it does have that kind of coffee shop ambiance. I mean, it's not a fine dining restaurant. I think the oilcloth, the tables are covered with oilcloth. You can't spend more than $10 on a meal.
And if you really get energetic and eat a lot, you can just jump in the ocean and swim 90 miles to Cuba.
Go the other way.
I mean, you're practically in Cuba. And I mean, if Cuba and America were at all thoughtful about Jan and Michael Stern, who drive everywhere, they would at least build some sort of a bridge so we could get there.
Hey, speaking of coffee, how's the Cuban coffee there?
Spectacular. Of course, you get either espresso served in those little I cups.
Right.
Very inky, very dark, very strong. Or you can have the cafe con leche. And what you want with your coffee is a piece of real key lime pie.
And where else but to have key lime pie than in Key West? Okay.
It's the only place.
And also flan. Do you think flan is funny?
What do you mean?
Funny in what way?
Jane, explain.
Okay, I have heard more stand-up comedians.
Just the word flan?
Yeah, like sort of making a joke about the word flan. I think even on some episode of Friends, they make fun of flan. And I don't get the humor.
I'm sorry.
I don't get the flan humor.
If these ignorant boobs want to make fun of a word like flan, let them do it. But I don't see anything funny about flan.
Well, maybe some of our new listeners in Miami can tell us why flan is a whipping boy.
Cannot wait to hear those phone calls, Jane. Thanks, guys.
Bye,
Happy
Lynn.
Flan to you.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, you get to hear the Sterns first here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, every week, we send you a fast weeknight supper recipe and shopping and technique tips. Now, this week, it's a great way of turning leftover Easter eggs into a spring country supper. But the only way you can get the recipe is to sign up for the newsletter. But don't worry, it's free. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org.
Okay, I'm ready now.
Joshua Wesson is a sommelier and wine writer who crossed into the light. Instead of convincing customers $100 for a bottle was a mere bagatelle, he now tracks bargain wines all over the world. Josh is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops, and he drops by each month with his new finds. Josh, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Josh, I was at a dinner party the other night, and we had cheese and wine for dessert. And it occurred to me, one of the toughest things to do is to pair a wine with a really stinky, aggressive cheese. I think this is a big challenge. These are the things that I lie awake at night thinking about. So what is your take on that? What should go with big cheeses?
When you come across cheeses, I know why you lie awake at night, you know, because you can't go to sleep when you're smelling an époisse or a real good Ami du Chambertin or Mariol, something, you know. These are cheeses that emit these aromas that make your gym socks smell like Chanel.
Yes.
I mean, you know, they scare people. And there isn't much in the world of food that scares people like stinky cheese. And you know, the great irony of stinky cheese is that when you taste them, they're mild and delicious. They may be full of flavor, but the flavor is never as aggressive as the smell would seem to suggest.
Mm-hmm.
So the key is to get people over that barrier and get them to try the cheese. And of course, once you've got the cheese in your mouth and you realize how it's oozing, you know, deliciousness from every mortal fissure, then it's not such a leap of faith to find wines that go with them. And these are my favorite cheeses in the world. I love dirty, rotten, stinky cheeses more than any others because they're cheeses that never back down. They're cheeses that you remember long after you've had them. They're cheeses with a message, and the message is, put the weapon down and move away from the vehicle.
Yes, but you're right. There's nothing namby-pamby about them. But does this mean they need a red?
Well, you know, people think that strong-flavored cheeses need strong wines.
Yeah.
And that's true with stinky cheeses. But you don't need strong reds with stinky cheese because what happens with a strong red is that the tannin starts to muscle around the creamy flavors, and you end up making the cheese bitter, and the wine fractures into its component parts, and you'll taste the tannin in the wine and the alcohol, and you might get a little bit of the fruit, but you won't get them all together, and it'll be more unpleasant than it will be pleasant for most folks. So when I approach a table full of runny, stinky, oozy cheeses, my mind immediately synapses to full-flavored, rich, white wines, and that's what I reach for when I have wine with these cheeses.
Am I hearing Chardonnay?
You know, you might think Chardonnay because it's full of flavor, but
right.
I stay away from wines, white wines, that have wood on them because that wood, that bitter component that you get in oak, will fight with the rinds of the cheeses because most of these stinky cheeses are washed rind cheeses or cheeses with a bloom of mold on them. And if you bite into those rinds, they're edible, but they're a little bit bitter.
Right.
And the bitterness in the wine can actually do battle with the bitterness in the cheese, and you end up having an unpleasant experience. So I stay away from wood, and I go to wines like Alsatian Pinot Gris, which I think are phenomenal, with a wide range of stinky cheeses. And, you know, their first cousins, Alsatian Gewürztraminers, which step it up to an even greater level of richness. I save the Gewürzes for the really, you know, stinky, runny cheeses. And then I go on over to Germany, and I look for Scheurebes, which are a hybrid grape, But a wonderful wine to have with smelly cheeses, because they do what Pinot Gris do and Gewürztraminers do, but they have a little bit more acidity, and that helps them cut through the richness of the fat. And all of these cheeses are pretty fatty on the palate, so you've got to have something that's going to unzip that richness if you want to have another bite.
So you're talking about wines that have fruit, but have acidity underneath that, so that they kind of wrap around that cheese and then cut right through it.
And sometimes they even have a little bit of sweetness, not so much that you would ever think that they're dessert wine sweet, but the sweetness acts as a way of amping up the fruit. So it enhances the fruit. You may get a touch of residual sugar in Alsatian Pinot Gris, but that's great for cheese. You get a touch of residual sugar in Gewürztraminer, also good. And the secret weapon that I pull out when I don't have any Pinot Gris or Gewürztraminer around, or Scheurebe from Germany, is Oloroso Sherry. It's one of those combinations that you don't think about until somebody gives it to you, and then voila, you have this epiphany. And some of the most magical combinations with things like Livaro or German Harz cheese was with Oloroso Sherry. It's just magnificent combos.
And you can keep that on the sideboard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, we put his stinky cheese wine advice on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, if those smelly cheeses need the wines that Josh described, they need a similar taste profile in the bread that you serve with them. A wimpy water cracker or baguette will not do the job, and a sourdough would be like those red wines that Josh talked about. Basically a disaster. What you need is something that's full of those round flavors you get from whole grains. You need some dried fruit and you need some nuts. I mean, basically what you need is the same elements as you get from the wine. Now, the French do it with their traditional whole grain raisin and walnut loaf. Oh, and if you're not sure what kinds of cheeses we're talking about, look for names like Époisse, Pont-l'Evêque, Italy's Taleggio, or Spain's Mahon. Coming up, how the world almost lost wine, spring's little orphan herb, and three meals on a plate in Harlem. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Considering how the world loves wine, it's curious how few of us know the story of wine's near demise. Now, this is not a tabloid moment. It's true. There was a time when winemaking around the globe was literally shaken to its roots. Now, British journalist Christy Campbell researched the story for his book, The Botanist and the Vintner, How Wine Was Saved for the World. Christy, welcome.
Hello, Lynn. Great to be with you.
So what is the story?
Oh, my goodness, Lynn, where should we start? Well, I think you got it right there. A lovely phrase I wish I'd used myself. The world of wine was shaken to its roots. And I begin my story in the 1860s in France, in southeast France to be precise, when this little calamity began to happen and the farmers began to see their vines, which they made their wonderful wine, mm-hmm. begin to wither and die, and nobody knew what was going on. But within 30 years, it had spread across France, destroyed two-thirds of the wine industry, the greatest wine industry in the world as it was then, had reached to Australia, to South Africa, and got to California, and where it indeed did the same thing. It wiped out California's vineyards at the end of the 19th century.
Now, what actually was going on?
Well, it's a story 60 million years in the making, if you like. What was going on was an ecological catastrophe, a kind of outbreak, if you like. If you can imagine an insect being transported across the Atlantic, a parasitical insect, finding a new raft of hosts to infest, but instead of just living with them, as any good parasite would do, just sucking their blood or sucking their sap, it actually destroyed them, it ate them alive, and had to move on voraciously to find ever more and more. And that is what happened.
And what was this called?
Well, it had many names at the time. If you say this word to any vine grower in the world, they will make a sign of horror. Uh-huh. And it's called phylloxera, and it means dry leaf devastator. And the man, it was a botanist actually, not an insect hunter, who gave it that name, did so because he observed the effects it had on vines. It turned their leaves dry, they fell off, and devastated everything in its wake. It has a different name today, a different scientific name, which I won't begin to pronounce because I'm not a scientist.
Okay. Now, who were the heroes in this story? You said it took 20 years to actually figure
this out. Yes, this is an epic struggle. Well, there are several heroes. I have one I'm particularly fond of, who's a Frenchman. He's called Jules-Émile Planchon. I put my best French accent on for that. And he was a botanist in the small... Well, it's a city, actually, but then it was a small town of Montpellier. And that was where it began. And when the farmers around Montpellier found their vines dying, they went to him and said, Professor, what is it? Come and help us. And he went into the fields with his magnifying glass and his collecting jar. And after many difficult weeks and months, they dug up a live, living vine, and he found what he described as a mass of microscopic yellow insects feasting on the roots. And that was the beginning of it. But the people in Paris ignored him. They thought he was a country charlatan. Mm-hmm. The government ignored him. The great vine growers thought he was a quack. But he just battled on. He would not take no for an answer. And after about 10 years, almost when it was too late, they began to believe him. And the tide began to turn.
What was the solution, ultimately? Because we still have wine.
We still have wine. Now, the solution was this. Now, how good's your biology, Lynn? Are you a biologist? Do you understand what a species is?
Well, that I've got.
You know, if you look at cats, it's the same animal, but they're not, are they? There are ginger cats and black cats and so on. But they're still the same species. Now, the vine is not like that. I'll go back in time. I said 60 million years ago. Now, this is what happened. There was one big continent linking America and Eurasia, as we know today, mm-hmm. and the world was full of vines. And when this continent split in two, which it did, and began to drift apart, it took the vines with them. And over the millennia, over millions of years, those in the United States, call it America, evolved in a different way. And they went off to make lots and lots of different species, about 60 different species. The one in Europe, left stranded behind on its own, is called Vitis vinifera. And it's the most important vine in the world because it's the one from which all noble wine is made. All those things we know about, mm-hmm. I didn't know when I started this, all those varieties you hear about, Merlot and Pinot and so on, they're all variations on this one particular species. So there we have it, these two cousins. And in America, along comes this little bug called Phylloxera and attacks the American vines. But they become resistant to it. They learn to live with it. In Europe, they don't. Now, you ask where the fix came from.
Yeah.
What they did was cut the American vine off at the roots and stick the European vine on the top and virtually glue it together. They used paraffin wax and little bits of tape. It's called grafting. And the American roots acted like a bodyguard, if you like. They're in the soil. They're tough and they're strong. They beat the insect, but they get the water, they get the nutrients from the soil, they send it up to the top, to where the European plant is growing in the sun, make it with its leaves, in all its different varieties. And my goodness, it made grapes, which you could make into fine wine. And that remains, after 120 years since they discovered this, how all wine round the world is made, from California to southern Australia. And it's a miracle, really. It was so clever, but it took a long time for them to find it out, and even more so, a very much longer time to persuade people this was the only way to do it.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like international cooperation, ultimately, at least, at its best. Christy Campbell, thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye, then.
Journalist Christy Campbell writes for England's Sunday Telegraph. His book is The Botanist and the Vintner, How Wine Was Saved for the World. One last thing. Phylloxera was never wiped out. It's still with us, mutating, and still dangerous. Even with modern science, nature just keeps outsmarting us. Chef Jerry Traunfeld has what you could call a dream gig. He cooks and writes at the Herb Farm restaurant outside Seattle. Now, the garden is legendary, and so is Jerry's food. You wait months for a table. But if you can't get a table, you can always get his book, The Herb Farm Cookbook. Hey, Jerry, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn. Great to talk to you again.
Jerry, I want to talk to you about the herb nobody knows, chervil.
Sure. Well, the French know it. It's used a lot in French cooking, but in this country, it's not very well known. And one reason I think is that it's very perishable, so you don't often see it in markets. But lately, it's been showing up quite a bit. And you know, the thing about chervil is, I always think of herbs with the seasons, just like any other vegetable.
Mm-hmm,
and to
mm-hmm.
me, chervil is the herb of spring. It's just got this wonderful, delicate quality. It's got a flavor. It's almost, has an anise-like flavor, but much milder than, say, tarragon. And it's got this just great kind of green freshness like parsley does. And it also has this pepperiness. And all together, it's just this great, I almost like to describe it as a very suave herb, because it's just kind of understated and very elegant, and it's very distinct still.
Could you describe what it looks like?
Well, it's in the parsley family, and it's an annual, so it's related to, say, cilantro and dill.
Mm-hmm.
But in the ground, it kind of looks like a parsley plant, but it has these lighter green leaves, and they're kind of smaller and thinner than parsley is.
I've heard that it grows like a weed. Is that true?
Well, for lucky people, it does. It's one of those things that you just can't predict. You know, some people can grow it and it grows like a weed, and then other people have terrible luck with it. Frankly, I have terrible luck in my garden with it. But it likes kind of dappled shade, and it likes cooler temperatures. And if it does like where it is, it'll just self-seed, and you'll always have it. It keeps coming back year after year.
What do you do with chervil?
Well, first of all, let me give you a couple of rules about cooking with it. And
okay.
The first rule is don't cook it. You never want to apply heat to it. So you always want to, say, sprinkle it onto foods at the last minute, or stir it in at the last minute into a dish. And the other thing is, kind of think of it in the way that, you would treat cilantro, where, you don't have to drive yourself crazy picking off all the little leaves, because the stems are very soft and they have the same flavor. So when you have a bunch, you just kind of take it and you can cut off the bottom stems, but then you just chop the rest coarsely and throw it in. So it's a very easy herb to deal with. And what I like to do with it, talking about, you know, how it's an herb of spring,
right.
It's wonderful with spring vegetables. So if you just have, say, steamed carrots or fresh peas from the garden, or fresh asparagus, or roasted beets. You just, before you put them on the table, just take some of this chopped chervil and sprinkle it on, and you'll get that wonderful fresh spring flavor, and just this beautiful color as well on top of the vegetables.
I would imagine it's great with fish, too, because you're saying it's kind of delicate.
Oh, yes. And that's another classic. So it's great with all kinds of seafoods. If I'm doing a simple butter or a butter sauce for a fish, I'll just, stir in a handful of the chopped chervil. Or if you, say you steam a bowl of mussels or clams, again, just at the last minute, you just throw in some of that chervil or sautéed shrimp also. And then in soups, and again with seafood, with fish chowders or even a creamy oyster stew or something like that, chervil is just excellent. And one of my favorite things is I make avga limono, the Greek lemon and rice soup with the egg. Yeah. And then I just throw in a handful of chervil at the end, and it just adds this whole other dimension. There's this little anise flavor to it that's wonderful. Mm. And I think, Lynn, if you never try anything else with chervil, and again, this goes back to spring,
right.
And the great food of spring is eggs, and chervil and eggs is the absolute classic combination.
Sounds really easy. Hey, Jerry, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Jerry Traumfeld is executive chef of the Herb Farm restaurant outside Seattle and is author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. Now, you can find Jerry's recipe for that chervil soup on the website, splendidtable.org. Mike Colomeco is one of the go-to guys for the New York City food scene. He's a former chef who now covers the city for his PBS series Colomeco's Food Show. Mike reports on the great neighborhoods, the new trends, the cooks, and the oddball dishes which seem to surface only in New York. Mike, good to have you back.
Hey, Lynn, always great.
You know, speaking of oddball dishes, can you talk on the phenomenon of chicken and waffles?
Yeah.
I mean...
I can tell you, I couldn't 3 years ago, but I can now. We were doing a show in Harlem in our first season, and we were hopping around, and I wanted to find out about this dish called chicken and waffles that I'd heard of. There's Roscoe's in L.A. that's famous. There's a place in Detroit. This is sort of urban African-American cuisine, and there was a place up in Harlem called Wells Famous, and the full name is Wells Famous Chicken and Waffles that's been there since the 30s. It's where it all started. They sadly closed about 2 months after we filmed. It was the end of a long run, but I got to interview Ms. Wells, the owner's wife. And I said, where did this thing come from? And she explained her husband had come up. He wanted to open a restaurant in Harlem. Everyone was serving hash and eggs and different things. And he wanted to do something different, and he started with this thing that he'd heard about where he came from in the mid-Atlantic Carolina coast called chicken and waffles, which is, believe it or not, fried chicken served on top of a waffle with maple syrup and butter. And I'm like, where'd that come from? Well, no one knew it. He had to literally give it away when they first opened. I mean, he actually couldn't get people to buy it, so it was come to Wells and get free chicken and waffles. Well, after not too long, he was busy as could be selling it. The place had a 60-70 year run. Sadly, it's closed, but the guy that's picked up the mantle is Carl Redding, who's the chef owner of Amy Ruth's on 116th Street. And I got to tell you, just Harlem has completely changed. People whose memories of Harlem are from the 70s and 80s movies and the crack days, forget about it. It's the second hottest real estate market in New York today. It's happening. Blocks are just being taken over. It always had beautiful brownstones. They're being redone. And Carl sits on 116th, which is this busy cross street, and he just does this great version.
So what is the place like? What is he like?
Carl is neat. He's about 6'2", bald, bigger than, he must weigh 300 pounds, and he's got a smile that has about a 1,000-watt light bulb. He's a super guy, and he learned to cook. He grew up in Harlem, and his parents used to get him out of the city in the summer. They'd send him to live with his grandma down in Alabama, whose name was Amy Ruth. And where all his brothers and sisters were doing yard work and cleaning the garden or painting the fence, it was too hot for Carl. He hung around in the kitchen with her. So this is where he learned how to cook. This is really his inspiration, and he opened up. It's expanded now, but ostensibly it's a square room. It's beautifully lit. It's got marble floors, great wait staff, real simple soul food, salmon croquettes, fried chicken, glazed ham. But his chicken and waffles rendition is extraordinary. The waffle is perfect. It's fried chicken to die for. And until I had it, I didn't get it. But it's what Mrs. Wells said. It's three meals at one. It's breakfast, brunch, and dinner, all rolled into one. So you can eat it at 10 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, on your way home from the Village Vanguard at 1 a.m., it just works.
I must say, as the more I think about it, as you're describing it, sounds pretty good. Really does. Hey, Mike, thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
New York Food Authority Mike Colomeco hosts Colomeco's Food Show on New York's PBS 13. Hey, I'm hot off the plane from San Francisco, and I have got a great suggestion for late-night Cantonese. If you go to San Francisco and you do not eat Chinese food, you're crazy. This is one of the largest Chinese communities in the entire country, heavily Cantonese. And late one evening, found a place called the R&G Lounge. Now, it's downstairs, white walls. There are tanks of shrimp bouncing up and down, live ones, okay? Big round tables with families eating. And this is what I had, and it was so good. It was, first of all, the shrimp split and steamed, just simply steamed with a little bit of garlic. It was sweet, succulent white meat. Then we tried what are called Three Treasure. And Three Treasure were big chunks of custardy tofu that had been stir-fried, and then chunks of eggplant that were stuffed with ground shrimp and spices and cucumber, and they were in a black bean sauce with a little bit of chili. And then to go with that, winter melon. It's called Chinese melon, and it was served with a dried scallop sauce. Now, I thought that was going to be really fishy. It turned out to be sweet and kind of delicate, not sugar sweet, but very delicate. And there were chunks of this very mild melon, and then kind of a wreath of bright green wilted spinach, and then thin, thin threads of this black seaweed that tasted very mild. And this was the best part. You know, most bad Chinese restaurants are serviced by what I think of as the brown sauce tanker truck. It's the same sauce, the same truck goes all over the country. It doesn't stop at the R&G Lounge. Every dish was distinctively different. So if you get to San Francisco, it's in Chinatown. We're going to post this up on the website. R&G Lounge, great Cantonese food. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. And surprise, surprise, it's about waffles. Here's the question. Where did the good old American waffle come from? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, where did the good old American waffle originate? Well, the waffle began in the ancient world as an embossed wafer. It was baked over embers between these flat hinged iron discs. And the discs were on long handles, kind of like a scissor. Later, they were going to become the Christian's communion host. Now, by the Renaissance, people started embossing their waffles with hex symbols, family crests, and special designs. Essentially, they were like party favors. Then the Dutch got inventive. They wanted substance, so they deepened the embossing on the discs, adjusted the batter, and created the waffle that we know, kind of a cake with pockets. Now, you can still buy this waffle in Holland and Belgium at snack shops. It comes coated in crackly caramel, and quite frankly, it weighs a ton. Anyway, it was the Dutch who gave us the waffle iron. They brought it to the New York area in the 1600s, and by coincidence, they farmed in a place on Manhattan Island that they called Harlem.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
The lines are officially open, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Terry from Charlotte, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Terry, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, well, hello, Lynn. I am a big fan of dim sum.
Oh, yeah.
The Chinese dumplings,
uh-huh,
and the bean curd rolls and such. But I, even at the Asian markets, cannot find the dumpling sauce. The only place I can find it is at the restaurants.
You mean the soy sauce sort of thing that you dip them in?
Yes, and it's a little bit sweet, and it has the garlic and the ginger, and I pretty much know the ingredients, but I don't know the base of it and how to get that sweet, that taste.
Generally speaking, have you tried making it?
Yes, but it just tasted like sugar and soy sauce.
Yeah. Well, generally,
I wondered if maybe it was something that you kind of, you know, like brew and get.
No. It's the easiest thing in the world. By the way, there are many different dumpling dips. You know what I'm saying? But they're all more or less in the same category. I'm going to throw out a thought to you. This is one basic. I do this now by feel, but I think these were the original measurements. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, it was a quarter cup of soy, two tablespoons of rice vinegar, or you could use plain white vinegar, and I've been known to use cider vinegar. Okay.
Okay.
A teaspoon of very finely minced ginger. And two teaspoons of sesame oil. You know, that's the roasted sesame oil.
It's the
great. That's great.
How much did you say?
About two teaspoons.
Oh, that's a lot.
Well, yeah, but you want that sesame taste. And then you want sliced scallion and a little chili and sugar to taste. But add the sugar after you get everything else together. And that way you have control. And those are the basic elements. It's the sesame oil, which you can decrease or increase. It's always the soy sauce. It's always the rice vinegar. It's always a bit of that ginger.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
You see.
And what about garlic?
Garlic can go in there, too. A small clove minced.
Right.
Very fine, really fine. And then the chili and the sugar are you due to taste. Some people leave the chili out entirely. And they just do a little bit of the sugar.
Well, I've had it a little bit spicy, and I've had others where it's just so aromatic, and I could just drink it like a soup.
I know. And usually when you have dim sum that has pork inside of it or very robust flavors,
mm-hmm,
or dim sum that comes from parts of China that's traditional in areas where chili is used, that's when you get the chili in it. Often you don't get the chili in it if the dim sum is coming from places where chili generally isn't used, or if the dim sum is really delicate. But since you're making it for you, you make it any way you want, and you mix it with anything you like. You can dip anything into it.
Yeah, I think that has dumplings down fine, but I always kind of go to the restaurants and take a little extra of their sauce.
And steal it and take it home, yeah. Certain other people have been known to do things like that, too. How else are you going to know if you've got it right?
Yeah.
But it gets so messy when it spills in your bag. Hey, thanks, though.
Well,
I think a lot of people are going to like trying this.
I'll come up with it eventually, and thank you.
You are welcome. Just remember, play with those balances.
All right.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
Hey,
bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up next? We have got Leslie from Singleton, Texas. Leslie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have had a question that has plagued me for a long time.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, when we talk about water chestnuts, what do they look like in nature? Are they like a nut? Are they a root? Do they grow in water? And also, I've had water chestnuts in Chinese food, and I've had water chestnuts in salads, but are there any other ways to prepare water chestnuts?
Okay. It is a plant that grows underwater. That's why they call it water chestnut. It's a water plant. And it grows near the rice paddies. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And in the real world, before it's sliced and put in that can, it has this brown skin on it. Sometimes you find it fresh in Chinese or Asian markets. And think about this. You're in Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere you can use jicama,
you know, that big white crunchy sweet, you can use water chestnuts. They're not quite as sweet, but if you can get your hands on fresh ones, they're just like Ikema in the sense that they're really sweet. So they can go with chili into salads. They're wonderful with citrus fruit, you know, and a little salsa over that. It's fabulous. Think about them going into dumplings. You know, if you're going to stuff something, put in the raw water chestnut, it'll give it a great crunch. So think about any place you put a crunchy piece of Ikema, this is where you would use a water chestnut.
Oh, what a fabulous idea. Thank you.
You are welcome. Hey, thanks, because I think a lot of people don't know that it actually comes from the water.
Yeah, I would never have guessed.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Call us 800-537-5252. We have Annie calling from Prescott, Arizona. Annie, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I want to talk about lambic.
As in the beer?
Yeah, the beer, but it kind of tastes like wine to me, and I'm really excited about it.
Now, what kind have you had?
I have had a brand called Lindeman's, and I've had their blackberry and their raspberry.
Yeah, this is really interesting because the beers come from Belgium. I mean, originally they come from Belgium. And I've not had Lindeman's. Is Lindeman's produced in Belgium or is it produced elsewhere?
You know, I don't know.
Oh. Anyway, wait, I'm going on and on here. What's your question?
Well, I wanted to know what would be good foods to pair it with because I really am excited about it and I want to share it. But I want to know how to share it.
Okay. For those who have never tried lambic, this is a beer that was originally created in Belgium and originally came from the Brussels area because it derives from a beer that supposedly could only be made there. It was done with wild yeasts. And what they did was they made this beer, which was really tart and sometimes aged for a year or so, and then they would steep it originally in sour cherries from a nearby town. It was a great tradition there. And it was called Creek Lambic. And then they started making it with raspberries. And then there's also a peach version. And then obviously other people started making it. But I agree with you, Annie. I think it tastes almost more like wine. And it's really not sweet, right? I mean, the ones I know are not sweet, but they have a real fruit quality to them.
Absolutely. That's what I enjoy so much about it.
Now, think about this. Anything with that kind of fruit is probably going to be great with things like barbecue, burgers with ketchup, anything that has a sweet component and even a spicy component. Because, I mean, think of it with Thai food, you know, or with spicy Asian food. Wouldn't that be fabulous?
Yum.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, absolutely.
This also, I've talked about this on the air before, but I, you know, a good thing should be repeated. I had a great dessert done with a cherry lambic by a restaurant here in Minneapolis called Vincent. And what they did was they took ice cream, right? And put it into a wine glass, a scoop of ice cream. You could use great vanilla. And they poured in ice cold cherry lambic. And it was in the middle of summer. It was hot as Hades. And it was so good because it does have that fruit winey quality. So you may want to really blow people's minds and do a dessert like that.
I am so excited to try that. That was exactly why I called.
Well,
enjoy.
So much. Enjoy. Hey, thanks for a great question.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. The term lambic, it's L-A-M-B-I-C, okay? And it usually means these beers that have been fruited. And if they're made right, they're not sweet, but boy, they taste of the fruit. And they're dynamite. And they were never really a gimmick. I mean, they really are a tradition. Of course, everybody's building on that tradition. We're probably going to have mango lambic soon, that great old native Belgian fruit. Okay, let's see who's up next. We have Gabrielle calling from St. Paul. Gabrielle, what do you want to talk about?
Yes, hi. I would like to know about a potato.
Okay, what kind of potato?
Well, see, in Germany, our potato salad, we make it like we have to slice the potato, and they distinguish potatoes between festkochend, which means like it cooks solid.
Right.
Mehlig kochen, which means like it
comes fluffy.
Falls apart.
It falls apart. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And that's good for mashed potatoes, but that's on the bags in Germany, and I haven't found a potato here that would distinguish between this. And I was wondering, what you think, you know, what kind of a potato I could use.
Yeah, this is the thing. You're used to using what we call a boiling potato.
Boiling potato?
Yeah. Now, it usually doesn't say on the package boiling potato, but if it has a red skin.
A red skin?
Yeah.
But you're not talking about red potatoes.
No, although red potatoes would work. But if you see a red skin on a potato, and they're in all the supermarkets, that's a great potato for your German potato salad. If it is called names like White Rose, Fingerling, Redskins are usually called Redskins. But the great thing about a redskin is you don't have to read the word. You just look at it, and you know you've got the right potato. So those names, White Rose, Fingerling, Redskin, those are all going to be great potatoes for boiling and for making potato salad. Whereas things that are called Idaho or Russet, those are the potatoes for mashed potatoes.
Okay. Now, the red potatoes, they taste different altogether than the brown ones.
Yes, they do. They're first of all, they don't break up. You know, they stay firm, and they have less starch than the brown potatoes.
Oh.
And it's exactly what you want for a good potato salad. And they even have, to me, they have a slight hint of what you might call sweetness, not sugar-like, but a very pure potato flavor. They would be delicious just with salt. You know, because they're that tasty.
Right.
So look for red skin potatoes. And if you happen to run across something called a yellowfin.
Yellowfin?
It is glorious. It's not on the market all the time. In fact, I think it's coming on the market now. It's usually like March and April. But a yellowfin is just a delicious boiling potato. And in potato salads, it just sings. But you can always be safe if you buy a potato that has a red skin.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Reach us, guys, 800-537-5252. Well, this week, PBS will broadcast the first hour of a three-part series called The Meaning of Food. Now, this has been a 10-year project. We have one of the participants on the phone, historian and food writer Cara De Silva. Hey, Cara, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you have gotten a preview of the series.
Yes, I've been part of it, and I've also gotten a preview of it.
What stands out in your mind about it?
Well, I think the profoundness of a lot of the footage, which illustrates many things, some of which we already know about how important food is and the spiritual, the emotional.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah. I was particularly struck by a segment on the Makah, who are an Indian tribe in Washington State, who had voluntarily given up the whaling rights that they had gotten from the government when the gray whale started becoming extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came back, and they decided that they wanted to go back to whaling. And the material in this series around that is just extraordinary about the effect on them of this process. And the harpooner says that he regained his sobriety just to be able to be in the canoe and connect with his ancestors of thousands of years ago. His wife explains how when the men are whaling, she has to lie very still because of the connections between the whale and women. If they move, the whale then moves too much and they can endanger the men. And the most striking thing to me throughout, and by the way, they can no longer whale because it was decided that the situation had to be studied again.
Uh-huh.
But at this point, she says, and she really says it with tears in her eyes, that the biggest thrill of her life was to be able to feed her grandchild raw whale meat, something that she didn't have as a child, but that he can. Huh. And she describes the celebration around the landing of the whale as like Christmas,
right,
only better. And it's all for them, they say over and over again, about the connection to the ancestors.
What a story. Huh. Is there, are there the other sides of food, the lighter sides as well?
It's a very, I think one of the really good things about the footage is how varied it is. There are some pieces that are quite funny. There's a piece about what the guards at an airport, the agricultural people,
uh-huh,
what they collect in the course actually of only 2 hours There's a billiard table heaped with things that aren't allowable food at all.
These are like customs agents.
All over the United States. Yeah, they're the agriculture customs agent, and they show you the contraband room. It's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. It looks like it must be a year's worth. It's 2 hours worth. It's incredibly diverse, and they talk about all the reasons people give because it's so important to them to get the food home through.
Right.
You know, like it comes from the sacred tree, and they must let it through. It was the last thing their grandmother made, and they must let it through. And the customs people are very affectionate about it. And even though they're laughing, the audience still gets the message, which is so important, that the reasons that they're giving because there is such emphasis on ancestry and heritage, et cetera, and because having the food of home with you when you're not at home is such a critical thing. And the United States is not at home in the same way that their native countries are.
Yeah. Kara, thank you.
You're very welcome, Lynn. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. It's quite an extraordinary show.
Historian Kara DeSilva edited the book In Memory's Kitchen, A Legacy from the Women of Tarotson. She's featured in the three-part PBS series, The Meaning of Food, which will begin on April the 7th. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Stephen Wright. He said, if toast always lands butter side down and cats always land on their feet, what happens if you strap toast on the back of a cat and drop it? Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lukey. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.